Hey everyone, thank you for listening to Missing on the Crawl Space Media Network.
If you like this show, you will love Crawl Space, which is also hosted by us.
We launched Crawl Space in 2017, and we have a huge catalog of incredible and thought-provoking interviews.
Check out our entire network of shows at crawlspace-media.com. On February 9th of 2004, 21-year-old UMass Amherst student Maura Murray disappeared in the White Mountains of New Hampshire in one of the most perplexing mysteries of our time.
For years, we have covered Maura's case and the tireless online community that surrounds it in great detail. We have since expanded our mission with this series, raising awareness and shining a light on the stories of other missing persons.
We now sit on the board of directors of the nonprofit organization Private Investigations for the Missing, which was founded by Bruce Maitland. Bruce's daughter, Brianna Maitland, went missing from Montgomery, Vermont on March 19th of 2004, just 6 weeks after and about 80 miles away from where Maura Murray vanished.
Private Investigations for the Missing aims to assist with investigations for underserved families whose missing loved ones have been forgotten by the media or by law enforcement. Through our growing community, we hope to shed a light on these cold cases.
Families and loved ones can reach out to us at investigationsforthemissing.org. This is Missing. Welcome back to Missing. I'm Tim, here today with Lance. Lance, how are you today?
I'm doing fantastic today, Tim, and it is 100% because of our guest today.
I agree. Our guest today is a delight. We've had him on starting way back in, gosh, Lance, I think the single digits of episodes. I think I want to say episode 7 was the first time Clint Harding appeared on our airwaves, and he is back. The return of Clint Harding. This is probably going to be a two-parter because we just have a great time talking with him and can't make it quick. And we were talking for about an hour and a half. So we'll probably cut this one into two episodes, and it's very informative.
Yeah. One of the takeaways that I think is very important for myself is reconnecting with someone like Clint and hearing his thought process while he is independently investigating Maura's disappearance and how he can bring these items to the table. We can have a discussion, and we've had disagreements in the past, but ultimately we can move on beyond the disagreement and come to some sort of logical, either, you know, that's what you believe and that's not what I believe, or we can come to some sort of conclusion about some of these items. He loves going through his material and making corrections because he knows that that's something that's the responsible thing to do. And if anybody has listened to our show since the beginning, you know that we have made many mistakes and have corrected ourselves. It's important to do, we think. We will always stand by that, and it's good to have someone like Clint also in our corner when it comes to that. And we are in his corner as well.
Great points. I agree. And it was, you know, a little bit like hanging out with an old friend. I know we've never met Clint in person, or not yet at least. But yeah, I mean, it was just great reconnecting with Clint as well. So that's kind of the other level here because, you know, we've known him, I guess, since what, 2015, 2016 now. All right, everybody. I hope you enjoy these two episodes and follow us on social media at Missing CSM.
And hey, Tim, what are you doing next week, next Thursday night?
I'll be in Saratoga Springs with you and Josh Hallmark of True Crime BS. Our friend Marcella Hammer of the Saratoga True Crime Club.
We have some experts that are going to be there as well. We have DNA specialist Toby Kirschman, who worked on the Golden State Killer case. We have Dr. Christina Lane and Dr. Christopher Kunkel from the Cold Case Analysis Center at the College of St. Rose. And this is Thursday, June 17th from 6 p.m. to 9 p.m. at Putnam Place, 36 Putnam Street in Saratoga Springs, New York. You can go to eventbrite.com and search Saratoga True Crime Night to buy your tickets. They are going like hotcakes.
Thanks for listening, everybody. We'll see you in Saratoga. Clint Harding, welcome back to the podcast. How are you tonight?
Tim and Lance. I haven't seen you guys in a little while.
This is me.
A while.
This is me clapping for you. I'm so excited to have you back on.
Well, thank you. Thank you, guys.
Thank you. Before we started recording, you said that the past year plus, you felt like a brown recluse wandering around your apartment, and I think that really sums up. You said that and it clicked with me. I feel like a brown recluse, but I can get it. Like, I almost right. feel that way, like, because it even gets to the point where you start to get like irritable and
right.
and then you're like, you do feel like this little creepy crawly like spider, don't f- with me type thing. And
well, I'm like that anyway, but no.
But you're very jovial right now, and it looks like you've taken care of yourself, you've stayed busy, and can't thank you enough for coming back on, regardless of what we're going to talk about tonight, because right. you're an old school guest. This is back in the day.
Been back in the early days.
Yeah.
I remember when Tim was just breaking in his first microphone.
And now we're all grows up.
Like I was telling you guys, being cooped up like that, it's been tougher than you don't even realize it until I think you actually get out and do something. Like, I went to Missouri for a week, and man, that was so nice. So yeah, if you're just kind of cooped up like that, that's pretty rough. But I think everybody's in some way has, because of COVID. And hopefully we're putting those days behind us pretty soon.
Yeah, people are getting out and about now. So yeah. Hopefully there's a little more for that brown recluse in you to explore. Well, Clint, we're talking about Maura Murray tonight, the disappearance of Maura Murray. And you've done a lot of work. You've been to Amherst. You have been on these airways many times. And I know you wanted to start with a correction.
Yeah, there's a couple of corrections. This case, you're going to have these kinds of things, and it's important that we try to get as factual as we possibly can. And I care more about that than I do, you know, going over corrections. So
before you get into the corrections, real quick, we can only just do this for 1 minute, because yeah. it's basically a yes or no. We didn't get into a fight at any point, did we?
Oh, throughout the years?
Yeah.
No,
I'm not forgetting something.
I was harsh on you guys and early on. I think it was around the time you interviewed Rick Graves. I don't remember why that set me off. But anyway.
Oh, no, I totally remember that. But, you know, that's something where you can reach out and you can criticize, and then we have a right. dialogue via right. email or even on the phone. But we never had like a falling out, right?
No.
Okay.
No, not like some of your guests. Boy, some of the people are just... in this case.
Yeah.
And we're not going to elaborate on that.
That was the reason why I was asking, is because it's we have a handful of people that we like to keep in touch with because like we can have these disagreements and
right.
follow back up with, you know, so how was your weekend or something like that.
Correct.
You know what I mean?
Right.
Like, how you've been hanging in there during COVID right. instead
You're
of
not
just
wanting to turn
spiraling.
Me into the police or anything, are you guys?
No.
All right.
No, just sir.
Check. Well, the interview's young.
All right. First correction of the night is we're going to deal with the episode 12. If that's way back when there, everybody was still kind of fresh with this case, but we were talking about Robinson Ordway. That was her screen name. I won't use her real name. But she is the person with the official red truck sighting. And I think you guys know what I'm talking about. And I had described her as saying that she had an eagle, or she described the truck as having an eagle decal on the back. And that's what I didn't say it like, you know, I quoted her or anything, because I have every quote that she's ever gave, and she's never said anything about an eagle decal. But I attributed her to being a person who said, eagle decal on the back of the truck. Now, why is this important? It's like the definition of this case is, I mean, if you try to go back and figure out where did this come from, where did this come from, it'll take you down so many different rabbit holes. It's insane. So basically, you know, I was just led to believe that this was what she said, because you have like New Hampshire League of Investigators that have supposedly gone online and said that this is what this witness told them. And so, you know, I don't question everything that I see. And so certain things I kind of take as, you know, truth, but in reality, there's actually two different red truck sightings, and that somehow that they got merged together. So you have Robinson Ordway's account, which is everybody I think agrees is very credible. It's very truthful. She's always been consistent. And then you have another red truck account that just, I don't even know if it's real. It could be a red herring, or it could be, you know, but anyway, do you guys know anything about the second red truck sighting that people talk about? It goes, there's rumors have it going like five different ways.
Was that the one that was in the collision report?
No, this one was a red truck that was supposedly found parked on Bradley Hill Road. So that's right around the area of the crash. So the different accounts are, there was a truck parked somewhere alongside Bradley Hill Road with the door open. That's one account. Then the truck turned onto Bradley Hill Road and supposedly Robinson Ordway saw it, which obviously that's wrong, because she wasn't anywhere near the accident location that night. She was walking from her home, which was the other direction to the Swiftwater store. And then you have somebody was walking their dog and they encountered this red truck on Bradley Hill, and the dog got spooked by something going on in the bushes, and the dog wouldn't walk any further. And so, I mean, this thing has taken such a life of its own. But anyway, supposedly that's where the eagle decal comes in, because that truck supposedly has this eagle decal on it. I don't know if the New Hampshire League of Investigators just gets it wrong, or there's some bad information. I remember getting frustrated with Detective Columbo. Do you know who that is from the Topics era?
Right, is that John Smith?
John Smith. I remember getting into him over that, because it made me so mad, because he would just bring it up over and over, this red truck sighting on Bradley Hill Road. And I'd always ask him to elaborate, and it just never went anywhere. And I don't think he purposely, you know, made this thing up. I think it's something that he saw either from one of these these investigators that he talks to or something like that. So I don't even believe in this second red truck sighting. And the cynic in me even wants to go a little further, because there is a suspect that often gets talked about on the forums, and especially in Topics back in the day. I know you guys know who this suspect is, and I'm not going to use his name, but he's a prominent concrete guy or something in that area. And supposedly he had a red truck that had an eagle on it. So it's just kind of convenient that truck ends up right by the accident location, right around the time that Mara went missing. And then nobody can seem to vouch, you know, provide any details about it. They can't provide a 911 log that has anything about a call going in. Cause that was another rumor. Somebody from their house saw this truck and called 911 about it, cause they thought it was suspicious, but you can't find that anywhere. So
it sounds like local rumors kind of
just went crazy.
And that combined with message boards, is that where most of this information came from?
I attribute it to the investigators there, the ones that were kind of volunteers for the the family. And maybe, you know, and you don't know if these guys are, because I do believe that there was a guy named that went by the handle Weeper. And I do believe him to be a legit investigator, but it's possible that maybe that person was just pretending to be, you know, this investigator. So, you know, maybe that truck rumor is true. I mean, maybe there is some, or maybe it's kind of a one of those deals where maybe it happened like in the afternoon, and then it's just kind of over time, it just got closer to when Mara went missing and closer to where her car was found. So I just don't put any credit into that second sighting, and that is where the Eagle decal came from.
Great to know.
That's interesting. So I get it straight in my head. The correction is the Eagle decal that was in the window was you had originally attributed that to Robinson Ordway's sightings, but it was sort of conflated with this other rumor of a truck that was around Bradley Hill that was parked, where that report stated that this red truck had an Eagle decal on it.
Right. Yeah, the different rumors put this Eagle decal on this truck.
Crazy. I mean, yes. After all these years and all these episodes, like having something like that pop up, I mean, what else is out there, right? What other conflations are out there? If that's
I'm
even
sure
worse.
There's more. I'm yeah. sure there's more.
But I'm curious why you think that this is truly just a rumor and this red truck does not exist.
Well, like I said, you know, even back in the day, I was questioning people about it. And like John Smith was one, but there were others, and nobody ever provided any kind of backup to it. You know, it always died really quickly when you tried to press people for answers. So I even called it out and said it was, you know, BS back then. So, and maybe it was real. Like I said, it could be real, but it could be something to where it really didn't have anything to do with. But, you know, it just kind of the story just kind of changes and merges and gets confused with everything else that was going on.
But the actual story is from Robinson is credible.
Very credible. Yes.
We're saying the additional reports of red truck sightings are not so credible.
Not that I don't believe they are. And to further add, you guys know who Folk is, Folk Stop. He did actually reach out to Robinson Ordway. I think it was in 2019. And he asked her directly, you know, did you see an Eagle decal? And her exact answer was, no, I did not see a decal. So, and another thing, and she was attributed to being the person walking the dog too in some of those rumors. So those definitely got merged at some point by some, and it could be an innocent explanation. It doesn't necessarily mean that somebody purposely tried to interject a red truck that they wanted the suspect looked at, but that's the cynic in me believes that that's what happened.
We'll be right back after a quick word from our sponsor.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Thanks to our sponsors, and now we're back to the program.
I did send you guys a application form for the dorm monitor job that Mara would have had, and I got that in 2009 when I first started really looking into this case. I talked to somebody at Dickinson to try to verify some information. So basically, those hours have always remained the same. That form would be the exact one that she would have filled out to get that job. So hopefully you can display that so the viewers know what we're talking about when this episode airs. Again, when I interviewed Karen and back in the day, I think it was like 2015 or something like that, I wanted her to give me a first person account, kind of like you would go into a police station and write down a witness statement of that whole Thursday night. And so I didn't have any prodding questions or leading questions to her. And I think it's just kind of, I don't know. I don't think you can ask somebody this many years later, you know, what time did you encounter Mara Murray? And her answer to me when she was writing out her statement, she never used a time once at all. So that is very important to understand. So as far as her getting confused on times, I think that's you know, that's a pretty reasonable thing to kind of expect for somebody to try to recollect something from well over 10 years old. I did talk to her recently on one of the message boards. Actually, it's probably been about 6 months ago, and she wanted to clarify a couple things. First off, she says times become difficult to pinpoint so many years later. I always had the times in connection to when her shift ended, but the shifts always ended at different times. And so I kind of have the range that she encountered Mara that night, that Thursday night, as being from anywhere from 12:40 to ending that night where she watched Mara go off to her dorm room at 1:20. Somewhere in that range is when she went to and had her encounter with Mara. So it's 12:40 to 1:20. It could be 12:50. It could be 1 o'clock that she showed up at the dorm Mara was working at, but and around 1:20 is when she took her back to the to Kennedy Hall where Mara lives, which is only a few steps out the front door of the Melville Hall that she was working at. So, and then when I did interview her, here's exactly what she said. So this is her only reference to time, is that I then told her if she wanted when I got off shift in a little while. So that tells you right there, if their shift ends at 2 a.m., that, and she's going to say that when I got off shift in a little while, we could go get some Dunkin's together because Dunkin's is still open, that we're talking more in the range of 2 a.m. and not 10:30. So hopefully we can put this to rest, that the encounter between the supervisor and Mara did not happen at 10:30 p.m. because I know that gets confused a lot. And I know we've talked about it a lot over the years, and we still don't seem to have that nailed down as a fact, but I hopefully we can do that, because I've always had that application packet, like I said, since 2009. So the hours have never been in question to me.
Okay. So her shift ended at 2 a.m. is, yes, what you're saying, on that Thursday night, because right here in the application packet, it gives the hours of the shifts. Sunday, right, through Wednesday, 8 p.m. to 12 a.m., Thursday, 8 p.m. to 2 a.m., and Friday and Saturday, 8 p.m. to 3 a.m., it says, with two asterisks, this is a night position.
Correct. And then what pisses me off, and I'm sorry to use the cuss words already this early, is that if you go right now to the UMass Police website, because they will talk about these positions, their exact wording on their website right now, same as it's been for all these years, is residence hall security personnel staff the lobbies from 8 p.m. to midnight on weekdays and 8 p.m. to 3 on weekends. They don't even get Thursday night at all in there. So, and that's the official police website. It's something that's, again, it's easily, I think, can get muddled up there, but the reality is the encounter did take place closer to 2, not 10:30. And that's pretty important, I guess, if we're looking at other things like phone calls and things of that nature to try to determine what happened that night. She also wanted to clarify a couple other things. So she's a supervisor, right? But on that particular night, she was the area supervisor. She was not the Southwest dorms, which is where Mara was working. She was not the supervisor for that set of dorms that night. So normally on a shift, she would encounter Mara 2 times, maybe 3 times at the most, if she was working in the Southwest dorm area. But on that night, she would only encounter Mara once, and because she had to make rounds all throughout campus that night. And the reason why she ended up going to check on Mara is because the supervisors that were in charge of Southwest, they found Mara upset, and they knew that Karen knew Mara, so they wanted Karen to go deal with Mara because they knew that she knew Mara better than they did. So that's how that came to be. Okay, and I want to tail that into the Patrick Vossi hit and run angle, because I know we've talked about that before, and I want to find out from you guys where you're at on the Patrick Vossi hit and run angle current day.
I don't really have anything new to add. I would just say I think if you take a step back, it seems like a lot of pieces would fit into place if there was some truth to Vasi being hit by the Saturn. But I don't think it is true. I'll go out on that limb. I don't think so. I just think we probably would have known by now.
Yeah, you could try to make the timeline fit on that if you really tried. But the main fact is that this poor individual was hit and went into a coma, luckily survived. I don't see Mora not telling anybody. I never met Mora, but I don't see her being that upset, because that's one of the reasons people give, right? Is she was that upset,
right?
But if she was that upset, was she upset because she didn't tell anybody? I feel like she would have told somebody. I feel like she would have. I don't know. It's just my feeling on this. She would have wanted to make sure that this guy didn't die.
Yeah, and that is a key point that you bring up, because at the time, I guess, the hit and run took place, they didn't know if he was going to survive. And obviously, we know future on that he was in a coma for a long period of time before he came out of that. So that would be a very spooky situation if you were to be the one involved. But again, like Lance brings up a good point. You wouldn't know at that exact moment probably the seriousness of it. Now, if you saw a newspaper article about it maybe a day or two later, maybe that brings it into perspective a lot more. And that is one of the things people will bring up and say, you know, that came out on Monday. There was a newspaper article that came out on the hit and run on the Monday that Mora disappeared. Now, I want to preface that, and I think I've done it before, but I want to make sure everybody understands. There was also another newspaper article that had come out a day or two earlier than that. So if we're just going to try to say that the newspaper article on Monday is the reason Mora split campus, then that wouldn't be accurate, because there were at least two different newspaper articles that came out. And that doesn't mean Mora, she may not even read either of the newspapers. So, but just wanted to bring that point up. So that brings us to correction number two on the Patrick Vasi hit and run angle. And that is, and I know we've talked about it on your show before, is the location is wrong from where I thought it was. And it's only 0.2 miles away from where I originally thought it was. And I want to explain how that happened. So the original reporting actually had a diagram that showed the location of the hit and run accident. Well, it was wrong. The location, there's two intersections of Mattoon Street and Triangle Street. They're real close to one another. What happens is Mattoon, you enter Mattoon off a triangle, and it wraps around a swimming pool and a baseball field, I believe. And then it comes back on the other end and meets back up with Triangle. So I always thought it was the intersection that was closer to campus where Mora was working. And it's actually the other intersection that the hit and run took place, where Vasi was found. He was actually found, I believe, on Triangle Street. But anyway, I just wanted to make that correction there. It was early reporting had it at the other location, and that was wrong. And I went off the police report that I got off of Mr. James Renner's website, and that's how I was able to determine that finally. I never even thought to look at that, because I always thought it was factual, you know, and that, again, that's going to happen with this case.
Mm-hmm. And how did you determine that it was wrong?
The address on the accident report says 48, let me see where I wrote that down here, 48 Triangle. So I looked up 48 Triangle, and it takes you right to that other spot as opposed to the first spot. Doesn't really change anything, but I wanted to obviously want to get that out there. I did want to continue on a couple things on the Vasi hit and run angle. So when I visited the campus in 2011, I wasn't even entertaining this theory at all. But I do remember being in lot 50, the parking lot on the campus that's just right next to Melville Hall where Mora was working. Lot 50 is a kind of, it's an employee parking lot, and it has a blue permit. And if you want to park there, you have to pay, I think it's extra money to get that parking spot. I could have swore I remember seeing a sign where I parked my rental car that day. It was a Saturday. It's in the summer, so there ain't a lot of people there. But I was worried still, because it said for security only. And I was worried, you know, I don't want to venture too far away from my car and then come back and it's towed away. I just remember that. And that's the only, and again, I wasn't looking at the Vasi hit and run angle. But the whole reason I'm bringing this up is That parking lot is really close to the doors Mara was working at, and people will argue against her being involved in the hit and run because she was working. And if she had a break, she would have had to go all the way back to her normal parking spot to get her car to go on break. And they're just, the time doesn't add up that she would have had time to do that. But if she was able to park in that employee parking lot, it would have been no problem. It would have been like 30 seconds. So I did talk to Karen about this. I wanted to clear this up with her supervisor. And I think her supervisor said, for one, they don't get the breaks that I thought they got. You know, you're working a 6-hour shift that night, 8 p.m. to 2 a.m. So I would think by law, you would have to be required at least a lunch break or something. But she kind of made it sound like they only got like bathroom breaks, and it would be like once or twice a night. So I just don't see Mara having the time to get out and be able to be involved in this hit and run accident, even though it's possible she could have parked in that lot 50. But again, she didn't have I don't think she had a blue permit on her car either. So that would be another thing that would rule against it. So I'm kind of with you guys. I don't think she was involved. I've gone back and forth over the years on that, on whether she could have, because there are some things that just kind of, you know, you hear, oh, you know, this hit and run took place on the other side of town. Well, that's wrong. That was wrong. It wasn't very far from where she was working at. So, but at the same time, you know, all things considered, and then you have the event data recorder, which is like the black box on the car. And you'll hear different things about those. You know, they don't record, or they'll record over events. So like if she had the wreck Monday night, it would have recorded over anything that happened prior to that. That is inaccurate. If you have any kind of collision, it's going to store that at least for 3 weeks, I think it was back then, on cars like that. So if she would have had something happen that Thursday night, it would have been on that event data recorder still that Monday night. And I think they did look over that. So if they would have found something, you know, it would have been that night.
That's actually a really good point, because we were talking in depth about that, and I'm wondering, yeah, you're right. They would have found something there, some sort of impact.
Right. Yeah. That no way that would have not left an impact or got that event data recorder going, because those things will go for, you know, a excessive speed change or something. So any kind of collision, I think, would definitely set that off.
It was so detailed. It gave the events of the impact during the accident within fractions of seconds. There was a small impact, and then the last impact that initiated the airbags. So
yeah, and those,
I mean,
things
are that sensitive. Yeah.
And they can like tell you if you're wearing your seatbelt or not. I mean, they can do so many different things. And so I'm pretty firm now in the camp that she was not involved in that hit and run, finally. Yeah. And I've gone back and forth over the years on that. I wanted to talk about Peabody. You guys know who that is?
Yeah, Peabody, Sharon Roush from Web Sleuths.
Yeah, Sharon Roush. So I found, you know, and I try to keep anybody that gives a quote, oh man, that's gold to me. I don't care who it is. I'll take their quotes over when it comes to this case, and I store them over the years. I got everybody's quotes, but she's been the gold. She's been the queen on the quotes, because she gives a very detailed quotes, and she always share her information. I think it's pretty accurate, you know, and maybe there's some spin in there, but there is one quote that I came across probably 6 or 7 months ago that I had never really paid a lot of attention to, but I want to bring it up again because it has to do with how Mara's dorm room was left. And I know, where are we on this, guys? Packed or unpacked?
I'm going partially unpacked.
Ah, from winter break.
Yes.
I'm going to go packed up to leave.
That's where I've always been. That always used to infuriate me when people would think that her room wasn't or that she hadn't unpacked yet for break. But so we know that there were pictures that were released. I think it was around the time the Oxygen documentary came out, and Maggie got a hold of some pictures, right? Mm-hmm. What was missing in them pictures? They didn't show the bed. And
true.
I think that's pretty important. Because if you go back to the Lieutenant Scorenza, who was the lead investigator of the case, He brings up the fact that this bed had stacked boxes. They were neatly packed and there was a note found on top of the boxes. And that has been led to a lot of dispute online over the years with family and just with people posting about the case. So, here was her quote. She wasn't even taught. And that's the thing about Peabody is she'll be talking about something, but saying something else that I don't even know. Anyway, I'm just going to read you the quote, and I want to hear your guys' reaction to this quote. The only person outside of police that was in the dorm was Mara's boyfriend. The only thing he told the family was that there was a West Point sweatshirt, all the stuffed animals he had given her, and all of the cards and letters that he mailed to her on the bed. What are your thoughts on that?
It sounds like she collected them or someone put them there as a message for him.
Right. Lance, what do you think on that? Because again, you know, if you think that she hadn't unpacked yet, do you think that that kind of counters that a little bit, or do you think?
Can you tell me again what the investigators said was on the bed?
Okay, so the lead investigator, he said that she had packed her boxes, neatly packed her boxes the night before, stacked them on her bed, and they left a note to Bill on top of the top box. That was okay. What he said.
And Peabody said online in a forum.
Right. And again, she wasn't really talking directly. What she was explaining it was who went into Mara's dorm room. I think that was the point of her post.
Okay. And what did she say? What did Peabody say?
Said that there was a West Point sweatshirt, all the stuffed animals that Billy had given her, and all the cards and letters that he had mailed to her on the bed.
And she said this.
On Web Sleuth, and I don't remember.
And what was her source?
Billy. I'm assuming Billy, yeah.
Well, that's a weird thing, too, because Peabody is not actually saying she's Sharon Roush. She's
right.
Like saying she's right. a friend of Sharon or something. So, yeah, great question.
You can tell by the quote because she refers to him as Mara's boyfriend. So she doesn't say, my son told me this.
So it was. It's sort of just an empty statement into the ether because it really didn't have any context was what you're saying. It had some context, but
I'm sure there right. was context, but not really. It wasn't really meant to highlight that, I don't think.
Okay, so your question was, what do I make of that?
Right. The specific items that were found on the bed,
the items that were found on the bed, according to Peabody, were just things related to her boyfriend Billy.
Well, and again, yeah, that since she wasn't actually in the room and maybe he was only talking about very specific items, maybe there was a whole bunch of other items beside that. So we don't have that context.
Well, I think it's odd to say, even if it was some random, even if it was some commenter on Web Sleuth that said the items on the bed consisted of a watch her dad gave her, a book her brother gave her, and running shoes her sister gave her.
Right.
I would find that extremely odd because that's not what the investigator said. Like, what is the reasoning behind making up?
That's why we need to see the picture. Damn it.
Right.
I know there's more pictures out there.
I attached the Instagram post from the photos that we were given by Maggie and the police for that. And you can actually see one of them has photos of bags, looks like a couple of bags of clothes on the floor.
Yeah, I saw that.
But it almost looks like cropped, right? That it actually looks like it's sitting next to the bed.
I was going to say the exact same thing as the way that was cropped. That is not, they sent me out to shoot a room of a missing person, that is not how I would shoot those pictures. So I don't know. Bet you there's quite a bit more pictures than what we saw released.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think that one's definitely cropped. And I don't, you know, obviously we don't really know why. But back to the Peabody thing for a second, it's really tough to tell if that's actually truth.
Right.
You know, as something Sharon heard which obviously she was very close to the investigation. I'm sure she's heard a lot of things that we haven't heard that are true.
That's why I got my listening ears on and my eyesight watching her. Every time I see a quote there, I like it. I don't have to believe everything 100% either, but I just like to have any quotes I can get from anybody really on the case. But that leads into, so now we have that note, right? And that note was in big dispute. The police officer, he referred to it as he's kind of an older guy, I think. So him calling it a personal note, I don't think is inaccurate, even if it was an email exchange, you know? And that was something that Peabody and that they kind of went online, or they not online, they went to the newspapers with and said, oh, he's trying to spin a narrative about suicide, saying it's a personal note when it actually was an old email or something like that. So I did get the chance to talk a little bit with Bill on the forums probably about 6 months ago also, on the note that he found in the dorm room. Okay, so
oh, great.
This is interesting because he says that there was no recently received personal note on top of the boxes when I was in her dorm room. I did find an email from 2002 tucked into the pages of a basketball program that was beside her desk. Now, that's interesting enough because police supposedly had gone into her room before him. And I would think that this note that the lead investigator brings up in his press conference with the FBI in Vermont when they were trying to see if the Maitland case was tied to Mara's case. And he briefed everybody. He brought up this note that they found on top. Do you think they would stick that note in a basketball program after finding it? So this is where he said he found it. Now, could there be more than one note? Yes, that's true. But then he went on to say, I did discuss this email with police while answering their questions about the topic of the email. I recall standing beside her desk when I saw the email. I don't recall if it was on her desk or perhaps on top of boxes beside her desk. That was his official answer. So bottom line is police did engage with him about this note. And so there is a note out there that exists. It's not fictitious. It's not made up. Now, you know, and the contents are between police and Bill. But again, if he found a note in a basketball program, I don't know. It just doesn't jive with what Scorenza was talking about and then with what they confronted him about. I don't think, again, that they would just tuck that note away in a basketball program and leave the room. And again, Bill, he was pretty clear that, you know, maybe there is a second note out there and maybe he doesn't even know about it. Maybe police have a second note somewhere that they didn't. But I kind of believe, since he went on to say that he talked to police about the email, that, you know, it's one and the same.
When a person goes missing, their loved ones often find themselves overcome with worry and grief. Bruce Maitland started the 501c3 nonprofit organization Private Investigations for the Missing because he knows this feeling all too well.
When Bruce's daughter Brianna disappeared in March 2004, he was surrounded by licensed private investigators dedicated to finding her. Now his mission is to provide dedicated private investigators at no cost to other families of the missing, desperate for answers but without the financial means.
Private Investigations for the Missing needs your help. To read the mission statement, make a donation, and keep up with our blog, visit us at investigationsforthemissing.org and follow us at PI for the Missing on Twitter and Facebook and Investigations for the Missing on Instagram.
Because forever is too long to wait.